Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. In today's episode, we will be reading Chapter 5. But first, let's talk about Chapter 4. The questions that I asked you guys are these. What are your first impressions of Alyosha? After seeing some dialogue by Fyodor, what do you make of it? And third question, why do you think Grigory erected the tomb? I am Norwegian, said. I love this chapter, especially this part. In his childhood and youth, he was by no means expansive and talked little indeed, but not from shyness or a sullen unsociability, quite the contrary, from something different, from a sort of inner preoccupation entirely personal and unconcerned with other people, but so important to him that he seemed, as it were, to forget others on account of it. Alyosha only gets more intriguing. The narrator describing his nature and behaviour is exactly the reason why I enjoy this chapter so much. I'm not exactly sure how to describe it, except that I buy into the choice of Alyosha as the book's hero, even after just a chapter. I laughed at the part describing children's propensity for vulgarity, that even soldiers would hesitate to speak of. That still seems to be true now, as it is then. I was also impressed by Dostoevsky mentioning how there's no real moral depravity or corruption in this kind of innocent vulgarity. I should probably learn to not be surprised at how insightful he is, but I knew that he was deeply religious, and I think that made me assume that he would not throw that youthful vulgarity aside so casually as something innocent. While I probably shouldn't, I also laughed when the narrator bluntly presumed that Fyodor developed a peculiar faculty for making and hoarding money after spending a few years with Jews, Jewesses, and Jewkins. It's funny about that children's propensity for vulgarity. I'm just casting my mind back to when I was, I'm going to say like 14, maybe 15, 16, yeah, maybe even 16. Probably the most trouble I ever got in was we'd get given these diaries every year at school, a big kind of thick diary to plan. It was called a planner, actually. And we were meant to map out our days in it, but you know, we very rarely actually used it for that purpose, but we had to have it on us. We got in trouble if we didn't have our diary, our planner, at every class. So we took around this book that we just really never used, and it was never looked in all the years of high school by the teacher. So what ended up happening with these diaries is that we all just used to scribble in each other's diaries and in our own diaries. And me and my mates, being 14, 15, 16 year old feral little Bergen kids, we just used to draw the most messed up cartoons we could think of, really. I remember we used to take TV shows that were popular, like I think we did one that was like Friends, and just make it as vulgar as possible. It wasn't even funny except for the sheer amount of immaturity. Anyway, I remember my mum found my diary and looked through it and was mortified, and I got in so much trouble. She really thought there was like something wrong with me. If you've seen Superbad, Jonah Hill's character, it was something a bit like that, along those lines. Anyway, let's move on. Tekrific said, yep, a mild form of anti-Semitism, so common in Russia and the rest of Europe, we barely notice it. To be fair to Dostoevsky, there were much graver slurs in other authors of his time. Not that I defend him, but it is easy to judge people in hindsight. Which this is in regard to that, Norwegian said, while I probably shouldn't, I laughed when the narrator bluntly presumed that Fyodor developed a peculiar faculty for making money and hoarding money after spending a few years with Jews, Jewesses, and Jewkins. Interesting. It's interesting to learn that. My opinion on this, from a writer's point of view, maybe this is just to cover my own ass, because I know it's true of me, But the narrator being anti-Semitic doesn't make the author anti-Semitic. And I think the narrator should be able to say anything. And the author should be clear for that. Because the narrator is a character, and why can't a character, a fictional character, be racist or anti-Semitic or bigoted or anything? That's my belief, you know? But how far do you go with that? Can the narrator use the N-word? And would I, a white author, be in the clear if I had a narrator say that word? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, no, I probably wouldn't do that, but it's just an interesting question to ponder. Dirt Burglar said, "This was great." This is referring to the children being vulgar bit. "This was great. It very much reminded me of my youth. When my friends and I learned to swear, we really went to town with it." Savvy Kid said, "Alyosha seems to be everything his father is not. Pure, sweet, and likable. The narrator's description of him does make me feel like he is a bit naive, though. I keep thinking that maybe Fyodor may not be the villain of the novel, but this is a very difficult thing to believe in when he acts the way he does. He is incredibly self-focused and does not show empathy for anyone around him except for Alyosha for a little bit in this chapter." This part was a really nice addition, talking about Grigory erecting the tombstone. Part of me feels like there could be a tale to be told about Grigory's relationship for Fyodor's widows, or maybe just to this one in particular. Or it could be that he understands that Fyodor is, for lack of a better term, an ass, and wanted to show her some respect. I'm curious to know about the narrator's relationship to his family, and how they know this information. They already gave away that they are staying at the monastery as well, so they are a character, but did Alyosha tell them directly, or is this tale and their reputation so popular that they are just writing it down? Only time will tell. I'm thinking about Grigory being their, their servant? Is that the word for what he was? He would have known the poor wife of Fyodor. So you can imagine that he might sympathize with her or pity her, even seeing her be treated so poorly. So they might have had a bit of a kinship over that. Tech-rific said, "Alyosha seems to be everything like his father. I agree completely, but the narrator does make a point of mentioning that the boy wasn't judged as naive by his peers nor by the adults, but later on get hints that he must be. I wonder though, of course, he hasn't lived very long, and as all young people are naive to some extent, as a function of not being on this globe for enough period of time to be any wiser. He is precocious, that much is certain. He is prudish when entering puberty, so that's pretty much textbook for any prodigious child, but he isn't really prodigious in anything except perhaps the capacity for tolerance and accepting people as they are. That's perhaps why his father is so fond of him. Fyodor doesn't feel judged. He can flaunt his debauchery and even discuss the possibility of an afterlife with his son." Dirt Burglar said, "I agree with this. I just keep thinking that his character will have a really interesting arc. So he's set up to be this awful person at the beginning. As you mentioned, it seems he's already starting to get along with Alyosha, and we learned in the last chapter that him and Ivan were getting along. Wouldn't surprise me to see him develop a true love for his sons and try to atone for his earlier sins." Swim said, "The Mama Fishy said, the first thing I thought of about Alyosha and Zosima was the Beatles and the Maharishi." I don't know what that is. There's a link there. Shall I go down the rabbit hole? Why not? Okay, I'm going to beetlesbible.com. There's a section about Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. The Beatles travelled to Rishikesh, India, February 8, 1968, to take part in the meditation course. This is when they all became yogis and weirdos, trippers, LSD trippers. Is that because he's joining the monastery? You see it as like the Beatles' trip to India? I like that. That's a good bit of mental imagery. Techrific said, this chapter was interesting. Finally, we're introduced to Dostoevsky's hero of the book. After reading his introductory note, we are expecting an unusual hero that readers might not associate with heroism. His superpower is his capacity for empathy and acceptance of his fellow man. Anyone who's ever read Dostoevsky's The Idiot would want to compare and contrast with the characters Mishkin. They are very similar but differ in very important ways. I don't want to spoil anything, so I'll leave it there for now, and maybe we can return to it later in the story. Very, very cool. Dirt Burglar said, Alyosha seems very naive to me. The narrator suggests that he may not even be religious, but rather was attracted to the monastery because of the monks, and Zossima in particular, were just good people. Maybe it's the atheist in me, but joining a monastery without religious conviction just seems a very strange decision. Fyodor's dialogue and descriptions in this chapter strongly suggest to me that he will turn out to be a more complicated figure than the simplistic bad egg we've seen so far. I've had that hunch from the get-go, just because I expect this novel to have deep characters that will not fit neatly into a box like good or bad. The final line of the first chapter, that people are usually more naive and simple-minded than wicked, presents as a major theme and leads me to think this about Fyodor. His aloof, rambling dialogue seems to feed into this even further. I still don't have a good sense about where the plot is going in this book, but I feel like Fyodor will become a victim as a result of his naivety. That said, I fully expect the story to go through a lot of machinations in which the relationships between and morality of each other, of each character, is in flux. The relationships between and morality of each character is in flux. I was really pleased to see Fyodor show some... Well, just to see his personality, I should say. Excuse me. Because in the previous chapters, we did get that hint that he was multifaceted, like a deep character. We saw him celebrate and mourn at the same time in that first chapter, which to me was a little hint that he's going to have layers to him and that those layers can conflict and that they can even coexist at the same moment. And then in this chapter, we really saw some personality for him, and it felt like a very real person straight away, the way he was speaking, and it was not what I was picturing, but it was also very clear, quite visceral. So that was really cool. Very masterful writing. Dostoevsky is renowned for bringing a character to life in multiple dimensions, you know, multiple faceted personalities, psyches, and they just feel real on this very deep level very quickly. So that's a talent. Mango Mondo said, anyone have any guesses on what is meant by the French description of hell, translated, I've seen the shadow of a coachman rubbing the shadow of a coach with the shadow of a brush? I did a little bit of a Google on this. Excuse me, again. And I found on Yahoo Answers, it's not really an answer to that question, but it does give a little bit more information. It's a French quotation from the translation of the Roman epic, the Aeneid, Aeneid by Charles Perrault, who is the same guy responsible for writing down the versions of various folk tales that we know today, like Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty. The lines are spoken by Aeneas, who visits the underworld and meets the ghosts of all his buddies and enemies who died in the Trojan War. He's describing how vague and shadowy everything is in Hades. Henry Laws said, Alyosha is a very interesting character, naive but relatable. Looking forward to learning more about him. I think Fyodor just accepted her and felt she did not deserve to be abandoned the way her husband did. I would think... Oh, I'm sorry, I'm talking about the wrong character. Grigory just accepted her and felt she did not be deserved to be abandoned the way her husband did. I would think his act will gain him a lot of respect by the two sons. Excuse me while I go and clear my throat with a glass of water. All right, I think that's better. No. Oh my gosh, come on. This is the problem with doing a podcast every single day. Is sometimes your voice just doesn't want to be a voice. One moment. All right, is that any better? That's a bit better. Excuse me, sorry. Oh, gosh. All right, where was I? I think I finished. Oh, I did. I read all the comments. Cool, that's the end of the discussion about Chapter 4. Very cool. Let's see if my voice can hold out long enough to read Chapter 5. Before we do that, as if I didn't have enough to say, and I wasn't stressing my voice enough, quick reminder, very quick this time. Aaron's book, Aaron Huggins, 15-year-old author. I mentored him as best I could. I'm very proud of the fact that I was his writing mentor. I don't like the word mentor because it's used by a lot of like self-helpy kind of things at the moment. But I'm using it in the classic sense of real mentorship, not like, you know, self-improvement mentorship. Anyway, why am I defending myself? I did my best to nurture his talent, and now at the age of 15, he has written a really funny science fiction murder mystery book, which is really good. And I don't mean really good for a 15-year-old, I mean really good. It is a great book, so I published it, and it's coming out on the 23rd of March. You can pre-order a copy now, if you would like, at upandupmedia.com.au. upandupmedia.com.au. You can also search for it on the Kindle store. It's called Live a Little, and it's by Aaron Huggins. 8 days to go until it comes out. Very, very exciting stuff. All right, here we go. This is Chapter 5 of The Brothers Karamazov, entitled Elders. Some of my readers may imagine that my young man was a sickly, ecstatic, poorly developed creature, a pale, consumptive dreamer. On the contrary, Alyosha was at this time a well-grown, red-cheeked, clear-eyed lad of 19, radiant with health. He was very handsome, too, graceful, moderately tall, with hair of a dark brown, with a regular, rather long, oval-shaped face, and wide-set, dark-green, shining eyes. He was very thoughtful, and apparently very serene. I shall be told, perhaps, that red cheeks are not incompatible with fanaticism and mysticism, but I fancy that Alyosha was more of a realist than anyone. Oh, no doubt. In the monastery, he fully believed in miracles, but to my thinking, miracles are never a stumbling block to the realist. It is not miracles that dispose realists to belief. The genuine realist, if he is an unbeliever, will always find strength and ability to disbelieve in the miraculous, and if he is confronted with a miracle as an irrefutable fact, he would rather disbelieve his own senses than admit the fact. If he admits it, he admits it as a fact of nature, till then unrecognized by him. Faith does not, in the realist, spring from the miracle, but the miracle from the faith. If the realist once believes, then he is bound by his very realism to admit the miraculous also. The Apostle Thomas said that he would not believe till he saw, but when he did see, he said, "My Lord and my God." Was it the miracle forced him to believe? Most likely not, but he believed solely because he desired to believe, and possibly he fully believed in his secret heart, even when he said, "I do not believe till I see." I shall be told, perhaps, that Alyosha was stupid, undeveloped, had not finished his studies, and so on. That he did not finish his studies is true, but to say that he was stupid or dull would be a great injustice. I'll simply repeat what I have said above. He entered upon this path only because, at that time, it alone struck his imagination and presented itself to him as offering an ideal means of escape for his soul from darkness to light. Add to that that he was, to some extent, a youth of our last epoch, that is, honest in nature, desiring the truth, seeking for it and believing in it, and seeking to serve it at once with all the strength of his soul, seeking for immediate action and ready to sacrifice everything, life itself, for it. Though these young men unhappily fail to understand that the sacrifice of life is, in many cases, the easiest of all sacrifices, and that to sacrifice, for instance, 5 or 6 years of their seething youth to hard and tedious study, if only to multiply tenfold their powers of serving the truth and the cause they have set before them as their goal, such a sacrifice is utterly beyond the strength of many of them. The path Alyosha chose was a path going in the opposite direction, but he chose it with the same thirst for swift achievement. As soon as he reflected seriously, he was convinced of the existence of God and immortality, and at once he instinctively said to himself, "I want to live for immortality, and I will accept no compromise." In the same way, if he had decided that God and immortality did not exist, he would at once have become an atheist and a socialist. For socialism is not merely the labor question, it is before all things the atheistic question, the question of the form taken by atheism today, the question of the Tower of Babel built without God, not to mount to heaven from earth, but to set up heaven on earth. Alyosha would have found it strange and impossible to go on living as before. "It is written, give all that thou hast to the poor and follow me if thou wouldest be perfect." Alyosha said to himself, "I can't give 2 rubles instead of all, and only go to mass instead of following him." Perhaps his memories of childhood brought back our monastery, to which his mother may have taken him to mass. Perhaps the slanting sunlight and the holy image to which his poor crazy mother had held him up still acted upon his imagination. Brooding on these things, he may have come to us perhaps only to see whether here he could sacrifice all or only 2 rubles, and in the monastery he met this elder. I must digress to explain what an elder is in Russian monasteries, and I am sorry that I do not feel very competent to do so. I will try, however, to give a superficial account of it in a few words. Authorities on the subject assert that the institution of elders is of recent date, not more than 100 years old in our monasteries, though in the Orthodox East, especially in Sinai and Athos, it has existed over 1,000 years. It is maintained that it exists in ancient times in Russia also, but through the calamities which overtook Russia, the Tatars' civil war, the interruption of relations with the East after the destruction of Constantinople, this institution fell into oblivion. It was revived among us towards the end of last century by one of the great ascetics, as they call him, Pasi Vilichokovsky, and his disciples. But to this day it exists in a few monasteries only, and has sometimes been almost persecuted as an innovation in Russia. It flourished especially in the celebrated Kozelsky Optin Monastery. When and how it was introduced into our monastery I cannot say. There had always already been 3 such elders, and Zosima was the last of them. But he was almost dying of weakness and disease, and they had no one to take his place. The question for our monastery was an important one, for it had not been distinguished by anything in particular till then. They had neither relics of saints, nor wonder-working icons, nor glorious traditions, nor historical exploits. It had flourished and been glorious all over Russia, through its elders, to see and hear whom pilgrims had flocked for thousands of miles from all parts. What was such an elder? An elder was one who took your soul, your will, into his soul and his will. When you chose an elder, you renounce your own will and yield it to him in complete submission, complete self-abnegation. This novitiate, this terrible school of abnegation, is undertaken voluntarily in the hope of self-conquest, of self-mastery, in order, after a life of obedience, to attain perfect freedom, that is, from self, to escape the lot of those who have lived their whole life without finding their true selves in themselves. This institution of elders is not founded on theory, but was established in the East from the practice of 1,000 years. The obligations due to an elder are not the ordinary obedience which has always existed in our Russian monasteries. The obligation involves confession to the elder by all who have submitted themselves to him, and to the indissoluble bond between him and them. The story is told, for instance, that in the early days of Christianity, on one such novice, failing to fulfill some command laid upon him by his elder, left his monastery in Syria and went to Egypt. There, after great exploits, he was found worthy, at last, to suffer torture and a martyr's death for the faith. When the church, regarding him as a saint, was burying him, suddenly, at the deacon's exhortation, "Depart all ye unbaptized," the coffin containing the martyr's body left its place and was cast forth from the church, and this took place 3 times, and only at the last they learnt that this holy man had broken his vow of obedience and left his elder, and therefore could not be forgiven without the elder's absolution, in spite of his great deeds. Only after this could the funeral take place. This, of course, is only an old legend, but here is a recent instance. A monk was suddenly commanded by his elder to quit Athos, which he loved as a sacred place and a haven of refuge, and go first to Jerusalem and do homage to the holy places, and then to go to the north of Siberia. "There is the place for thee and not here. There is the place for thee and not here." The monk, overwhelmed with sorrow, went to the Osimunical patriarch at Constantinople and besought him to release him from his obedience. But the patriarch replied that not only was he unable to release him, but there was not and could not be on earth a power which could release him except the elder, who had himself laid that duty upon him. In this way the elders are endowed, in certain cases, with unbounded and inexplicable authority. That is why in many of our monasteries the institution was at first resisted almost to persecution. Meantime, the elders immediately began to be highly esteemed among the people. Masses of the ignorant people, as well as of distinction, flocked, for instance, to the elders of our monastery to confess their doubts, their sins, and their sufferings, and ask for counsel and admonition. Seeing this, the opponents of the elders declared that the sacrament of confession was being arbitrarily and frivolously degraded, though the continual opening of the heart to the elder by the monk or the layman had nothing of the character of the sacrament. In the end, however, the institution of elders has been retained and is becoming established in Russian monasteries. It is true, perhaps, that this instrument, which had stood the test of 1,000 years for the moral regeneration of a man from slavery to freedom and to moral perfectibility, may be a two-edged weapon, and it may lead some not to humility and complete self-control, but to the most satanic pride, that is, to bondage and not to freedom. The elder, Zosima, was 65. He came of a family of landowners, had been in the army in his early youth, and served in the Caucasus as an officer. He had no doubt impressed Alyosha by some peculiar quality of his soul. Alyosha lived in the cell of the elder, who was very fond of him and let him wait upon him. It must be noted that Alyosha was bound by no obligation and could go where he pleased and be absent for whole days. Though he wore the monastic dress, it was voluntarily, not to be different from the others. No doubt he liked to do so. Possibly his youthful imagination was deeply stirred by the power and fame of his elder. It was said that so many people had for years past come to confess their sins to Father Zosima and to entreat him for words of advice and healing, that he had acquired the keenest intuition and could tell from an unknown face what a newcomer wanted, and what was the suffering on his conscience. He sometimes astounded and almost alarmed his visitors by his knowledge of their secrets before they had spoken a word. Alyosha noticed that many, almost all, went into the Alder for the first time with apprehension and uneasiness, but came out with bright and happy faces. Alyosha was particularly struck by the fact that Father Zossima was not at all stern. On the contrary, he was always almost gay. The monks used to say that he was more drawn to those who were more sinful, and the greater the sinner, the more he loved him. There were no doubt, up to the end of his life, among the monks some who hated and envied him, but they were few in number, and they were silent, though among them were some of great dignity in the monastery. One, for instance, of the older monks, distinguished for his strict keeping of fasts and vows of silence. But the majority were on Father Zossima's side, and very many of them loved him with all their hearts, warmly and sincerely. Some were almost fanatically devoted to him, and declared, though not quite aloud, that he was a saint, that there could be no doubt of it, and seeing that his end was near, they anticipated miracles and great glory to the monastery, in the immediate future, from his relics. Alyosha had unquestioning faith in the miraculous power of the elder, just as he had unquestioning faith in the story of the coffin that flew out of the church. He saw many who came with sick children or relatives and besought the elder to lay hands on them and to pray over them, return shortly after, some the next day, and falling in tears at the elder's feet, thank him for healing their sick. Whether they had really been healed or were simply better in the natural course of the disease was a question which did not exist for Alyosha, for he fully believed in the spiritual power of his teacher and rejoiced in his fame, in his glory, as though it were his own triumph. His heart throbbed, and he beamed, as it were, all over when the elder came out of the gates, to the gates of the Hermitage, into the waiting crowd of the pilgrims of the humbler class, who had flocked from all parts of Russia on purpose to see the elder and obtain his blessing. They fell down before him, wept, kissed his feet, kissed the earth on which he stood, and wailed, while the women held up their children to him and brought him the sick possessed with devils. The elder spoke to them, read a brief prayer over them, blessed them, and dismissed them. Of late he had become so weak through attacks of illness that he was sometimes unable to leave his cell, and the pilgrims waited for him to come out for several days. Alyosha did not wonder why they loved him so, why they fell down before him and wept with emotion merely at seeing his face. Oh, he understood for the humble soul of the Russian peasant, worn out by grief and toil, and still more by the everlasting injustice and everlasting sin, his own and the world's, it was the greatest need and comfort to find someone or something holy to fall down before and worship. Among us there is sin, injustice, and temptation, but yet, somewhere on earth, there is someone holy and exalted. He has the truth, he knows the truth, so it is not dead upon the earth, so it will come some one day to us, too, and rule over all the earth according to the promise. Alyosha knew this was just how the people felt and even reasoned. He understood it, but that the elder Zossima was this saint and custodian of God's truth, of that he had no more doubt than the weeping peasants and the sick women who held out their children to the elder. The conviction that after his death the elder would bring extraordinary glory to the monastery was even stronger. Even stronger in Alyosha than in anyone there, and of late a kind of deep flame of inner ecstasy burnt more and more strongly in his heart. He was not at all troubled at this elder's standing as a solitary example before him. No matter, he is holy. He carries in his heart the secret of renewal for all, that power which will at last establish truth on earth, and all men will be holy and love one another, and there will be no more rich nor poor, no exalted nor humbled, but all will be as the children of God and the true kingdom of Christ will come. That was the dream in Alyosha's heart. The arrival of his two brothers, whom he had not known till then, seemed to make a great impression on Alyosha. He more quickly made friends with his half-brother Dmitri, though he arrived later, than with his own brother, Ivan. He was extremely interested in his own brother, Ivan. But when the latter had been 2 months in the town, though he had met fairly often, they were still not intimate. Alyosha was naturally silent, and he seemed to be expecting something, ashamed about something, while his brother Ivan, though Alyosha noticed at first that he looked long and curiously at him, seemed soon to have left off thinking of him. Alyosha noticed it with some embarrassment, and ascribed his brother's indifference at first to the disparity of their age and education, but he also wondered whether the absence of curiosity and sympathy in Ivan might be due to some other cause entirely unknown to him. He kept fancying that Ivan was absorbed in something, something inward and important, that he was striving towards some goal, perhaps very hard to attain, and that that was why he had no thought for him. Alyosha wondered, too, whether there was not some contempt on the part of the learned atheist for him, a foolish novice. He knew for certain that his brother was an atheist. He could not take offence at this contempt, if it existed, yet with an uneasy embarrassment which he did not himself understand, he waited for his brother to come near to him. Dmitri used to speak of Ivan with the deepest respect and with a peculiar earnestness. From him, Alyosha learnt all the details of the important affair which had of late formed such a close and remarkable bond between the two elder brothers. Dmitri's enthusiastic references to Ivan were the more striking in Alyosha's eyes, since Dmitri was compared with Ivan almost uneducated. And the two brothers were such a contrast in personality and character that it would be difficult to find two men more unlike. It was at this time that the meeting, or rather gathering, of the members of this inharmonious family took place in the cell of the elder, who had such an extraordinary influence on Alyosha. The pretext for this gathering was a false one. It was at this time that the discord between Dmitri and his father seemed at its acutest stage, and their relations had become insufferably strained. Fyodor Pavlovich seems to have been the first to suggest, apparently in joke, that they should all meet in Father Zossima's cell, and that without appealing to his direct intervention, they might more decently come to an understanding under the conciliation, influence of the elder's presence. Dmitri, who had never seen the elder, naturally supposed that his father was trying to intimidate him, but, as he secretly blamed himself for his outbursts of temper with his father on several recent occasions, he accepted the challenge. It must be noted that he was not, like Ivan, staying with his father, but living apart at the other end of the town. It happened that Pyotr Alexandrovich Miasov, who was staying in the district at the time, caught eagerly at the idea. A liberal of the 40s and 50s, a free thinker and an atheist, he may have been led on by boredom or the hope of frivolous diversion. He was suddenly seized with the desire to see the monastery and the holy man. As his lawsuit with the monastery still dragged on, he made it the pretext for seeing the superior in order to attempt to settle it amicably. A visitor coming with such laudable intentions might be received with more attention and consideration than if he came from simple curiosity. Influences from within the monastery were brought to bear on the elder, who of late had scarcely left his cell, and had been forced by illness to deny even his ordinary visitors. In the end he consented to see them, and the day was fixed. "Who has made me a judge over them?" was all he said smilingly to Alyosha. Alyosha was much perturbed when he heard of the proposed visit. Of all the wrangling, quarrelsome party, Dmitri was the only one who could regard the interview seriously. All the others would come from frivolous motives, perhaps insulting to the elder. Alyosha was well aware of that. Ivan and Misuov would come from curiosity, perhaps, of the coarsest kind, while his father might be contemplating some piece of buffoonery. Though he said nothing, Alyosha thoroughly understood his father. The boy, I repeat, was far from being so simple as everyone thought him. He awaited the day with a heavy heart. No doubt he was always pondering in his mind how the family discord could be ended. But his chief anxiety concerned the elder. He trembled for him, for his glory, and dreaded any affront to him, especially the refined, courteous irony of Misuov and the supercilious half-utterances of the highly educated Ivan. He even wanted to venture on warning the elder, telling him something about them, but on second thoughts said nothing. He only sent word the day before through a friend to his brother Dmitri that he loved him and expected him to keep his promise. Dmitri wondered, for he could not remember what he had promised, but he answered by letter that he would do his utmost not to let himself be provoked by vileness, but that, although he had a deep respect for the elder and for his brother, Ivan, he was convinced that the meeting was either a trap for him or an unworthy farce. Nevertheless, I would rather bite out my tongue than be lacking in respect to the sainted man whom you reverence so highly, he wrote in conclusion. Alyosha was not greatly cheered by the letter. Alright, there we go. That's the end of chapter, whatever that was, chapter 5. And that's also the end of book 1. So tomorrow we'll be making a start on book 2, and we will be reading all of chapter 1, book 2. Okay, so tomorrow you can go ahead and read all of chapter 1, book 2. Very, very cool. Have your say about this chapter over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. I look forward to reading your comments and your thoughts. And thanks for listening today. I'll see you tomorrow.